And it is 9 a.m. in the West Coast. It is 12 noon in the East Coast, and it's 7 p.m. in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Today is Wednesday, October 19, 2016, and this is Orly Benny Davis with The Impossible Truth. Today on BBS Radio, I am here back on Wednesday, something new, but it's old, and it's really, really good to be here again. We want to talk about the debate that is going to happen tonight in Nevada, in Las Vegas, between two humongous people, people that have their credential, and if the world is watching, we all know how powerful they are. Everybody is watching. We all are praying for America's sake. And in the midst of everything, we have a great, great message from the Canadian. The Canadian that wanted to remind America that we are great. And as an American, even though I am living abroad, I really felt and touched. I was touched with the Canadian little message to the world. Let's listen to this if we have it.
What's up, America?
Hey, guys. We're just up here in Canada talking about how great you guys are down there. We thought we'd just send you a little bit of a love note.
We're big fans. We like you guys.
We know you've got some really big decisions to make. But as you're thinking about your future, we just want you to know that...
You guys are great.
You really are great.
You invented the internet.
You guys are going to get humanity to Mars.
Your national park systems protect some of the most beautiful places on Earth.
All your diversity... and all your openness.
The fact that you're such a giving nation, over $250 billion a year is donated to charities.
So wonderful and warm and accommodating.
When things are tough, you fight to make them better.
The disability rights movement in America is amazing.
You are infectious, entertaining.
Your gift to the world of jazz music.
Bluegrass music, R&B.
Biggie and Pac.
Political and social activism.
Forging new paths.
You dream big.
Your quest to be the best creates the best.
A land of opportunity where anyone can be anything they want to be.
The vibrancy and the diversity and the idea that we can all live together.
You know, America, I think you're already great.
You're great, America.
We all love you, and we think you've always been great.
Thanks, America. I think you're great.
Stay great, America.
And you know, guys, when Canada sent this kind message to the world and to the American people, I was in tears. Because I guess that something inside me is so American that once, you know, I want America back, want America the strong, want her spirit to be powerful, want America to be back on her feet as the leader of the free world. It's not easy. But we can understand what we had to go through, a change. Everything is changing in the world, and you can count on it. And it's not easy sometimes to face it and change within. So you have to struggle sometimes, and the challenge makes you better. And America is going to be better. And tonight, when the people are standing up and debating, they must remember that there is a God, and it's not them, and it's not us. So... a reminder, a little reminder for the kids around what's the Bible story sometimes tell us. Maybe we'll learn something.
Solomon was the son of King David and had grown to become a great king himself. Solomon was a very wise king and he did many great things. But the greatest work of Solomon's reign was the building of the house of God, which was called the temple. Solomon planned very carefully. That's because building the temple was very important work. It mattered a lot to Solomon. That's because his father, King David, had wanted to build the temple and had prepared for it by gathering lots of gold, silver, stone, and cedar. Solomon knew how much the temple mattered to his dad. He knew how much it mattered to God. So building the temple mattered to Solomon very much. He took great care to make sure everything was just right. The temple stood on Mount Moriah, which is the exact place where Abraham took his son Isaac to be sacrificed. The place where Solomon's father David had built an altar and the Lord appeared to him. This was a very important place designed for a very important task, building God's house. Cedar for the roof was brought from faraway lands, and all the stones for the building of the temple were chiseled and shaped and fitted together before they were brought to Mount Moriah. And all the beams for the roof and the pillars of cedar were carved and made to join each other. This was so that as the walls arose, no sounds of hammers or chisels were heard. God's house was built quietly. Because building God's temple so that people could worship was so important to Solomon, he used the finest materials to build it. The walls were covered with pure gold. He decorated it with precious gems. Nothing was too good for God's house. It took King Solomon and his men 7 years to build the temple, but at last it was finished. When it was done, Solomon brought all the things his dad, King David, had gathered for the temple, the gold, silver, and other important items. Then he had the Ark of the Covenant brought to the temple where it would sit in a place of honor, in the house of God. Finally, Solomon held a great service to let the people know the temple was ready. Solomon's greatest work was complete. He cared about the house of God. He cared about worship. So God used Solomon to build his temple where people could worship the one true God.
All right, we are back, and this is Orly Benny Davis with PBS Radio and The Impossible Truth. Today we wanted to remind UNESCO about the truth. You know, you cannot cancel history, and you cannot erase or eradicate any other religion, because the faith is something that hold people up. And for UNESCO to try to erase the Jewish and the Judeo-Christian faith by eliminating the rites on the holy places to the Jewish people and Christian, they are making a very big mistake, because they're actually going against God, and it's something that won't be. Let's listen to Trey Gowdy talking about truth and a message to the world, which is exceptional. We heard it last week on Monday, and we will listen to it now.
And then I ask them two questions. Which do you value more, truth or freedom? And every single person in my office said freedom. And I said, okay, which do you value more, unity or diversity? And every one but one said diversity. Look, truth and freedom are both really important. But at some point, you and your generation have to ask yourselves, what is the benefit of the freedom to be wrong? Do you really value freedom more than truth? Do you even think there is a truth? But we are, after all, the United States of America. So what is it that unites us? So I'll go back to the verse, and I think, well, is there an answer in that verse? If my people who are called by my name shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their what? Wicked ways. Well, maybe there's a start. Sure. Can we at least agree that there is good and bad? Or is everything relative? For 16 years, I never once stood in front of a jury and tried to convince them that murder was wrong. Never once. I never tried to convince a jury that robbery was wrong, that discrimination was wrong, that mistreating children was wrong. So there is a source of unity. There is a code by which we all have agreed to live. What is the source of that code? And if you are in that group that wants a better future than the present you are experiencing, if you don't like this disunity, if you don't like this sense of angst, if you don't like what seems to be forcing you to be detached and cynical about your country and your government, you got to do something about it. You got to figure out what you believe, and more importantly, you got to figure out why you believe it. It is never enough in politics or any other sphere of persuasion to simply tell people what you believe. You have to tell them why you believe it. Do you believe in respect for the rule of law? Let me tell you something about the law. It is the most unifying and equalizing force that we have in this country. It is the only thing that makes the richest person in this county drive the same speed limit as the poorest person. It is what makes the richest person in Virginia pay his or her taxes on precisely the same day as the poorest. So if you don't like the direction of our country, or you want a better future, what do you believe and why do you believe it? Secondarily, you can be the smartest person in the world, and if you can't communicate what you believe, you're not going to be very successful. So you do need a message, and that message better be why you believe what you believe, but you also need a very effective manner or method of communication. In other words, you need to learn how to persuade. How do you persuade in life? Facts, authenticity, sincerity, credibility. You want to persuade, change people's minds to come around to your way of thinking on whatever issue it is, and I don't care about your politics. They're none of my business. You can have whatever politics you want. But I will tell you what doesn't work: insulting people. Any of you been married for more than a week? Any of you aspire to be married at any point in life? Let me give you a piece of free advice after 25 years of marriage. Insulting people does not work if your objective is to persuade. Look, I did not vote for President Obama. I didn't vote for him. But you know what? A majority of my fellow citizens did. So when I see a bumper sticker that says, don't blame me, I didn't vote for the idiot, do you think that's persuasive? Do you think anybody that voted for President Obama is going to be persuaded, yeah, maybe I possibly made a mistake because this person called me an idiot? Life doesn't work that way. You know what happens when you're insulted? You become even more dogmatic in holding your incorrect belief than you were before you were insulted. So if your goal is to persuade, you shouldn't be insulting people. Let me tell you what else doesn't work. Hypocrisy. Telling other people how to live their lives, but you live your life a different way. You want to persuade people? Hypocrisy doesn't work. Insults don't work. What does work? A relationship. The person has to know that you care about them. They have to know that you care about them. There are two people in politics that I think do a wonderful job of that, and I don't care whether you support either one of them. One is Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio was raised by a woman that cleaned other people's hotel rooms. But she had hope. She had hope that her son would have a better life, and now he's in the United States Senate. And the other person who does a wonderful job of communicating hope is a guy named Tim Scott, who is my best friend in politics. And Tim Scott's grandfather, who's now 94, would hold the newspaper up every morning at breakfast. Wanted Timmy to see him reading the newspaper because of the value of education, the power of education. Wanted Timmy to be informed. Wanted him to be up on current events. So he held the newspaper up every single morning. Except he couldn't read. Can't read to this day. But he wanted to communicate hope to his grandson about the power of education. You want to persuade people? Do you speak in hopeful terms? Do you communicate hope? Are they convinced that you have their best interest at mind? So you got a message. You got a manner of communicating. And all you need is a messenger, right? You're just waiting on whoever that is. Whether it's President Obama, whether it's Ronald Reagan, whether it's Abraham Lincoln, we're just waiting around on that great messenger, right? If you are waiting around for another Ronald Reagan or another Martin Luther King Jr. or another Abraham Lincoln, you are going to have a long, miserable wait. It's not going to happen. If you're waiting on a knight or knightess to ride in on a white horse and change whatever you think ails our country or your school or your community or your family, it's not going to happen. You know who the messenger is? It's you. I work in a town that is named for Washington. I fly into an airport named for Reagan. I pass monuments to Jefferson and Lincoln and King, and every street is named after somebody famous, and there are statues and portraits in every one of the office buildings. I don't even know. They're so famous, I don't even know them. You know what I think about when I fly into Reagan? I think about a guy you've never heard of. You've never heard of him. I was about your age. I was exactly your age. Watching television with my father. February, in the throes of a terribly frigid winter in Washington, and a plane crashes into the 14th Street Bridge. And all the passengers except a half dozen were killed on impact, and those half dozen were in the icy waters of the Potomac River. And I'm watching this on television with my dad. This is before 24-hour news, but it was captivating the country. So you got these people in the icy waters of the Potomac, and you got the whirr of a helicopter coming. And that helicopter lowers a rope ladder into the waters of the Potomac, and it falls into the hands of a man you've never heard of before. If I called his name right now, you don't know him. So he has life in his hands, and he passes it to a stranger. And that person is hoisted to safety, and the helicopter takes her away, and it comes back, and the same scene repeats itself 4 more times. And every time, he's got his hands on a rope ladder. He is this close to saving his life. And every single time, he passes it to a stranger. Not his wife, not his daughter, not his best friend, a stranger. And when the helicopter came back for him, he had succumbed to fatigue and drowned. His name was Arlen Williams. I'm not asking you to be Reagan. I'm not asking you to be Lincoln. I'm just asking you to live a quiet life of conviction and virtue and actually live out what you profess to believe. And if you can do that, you'll be a leader. You'll be persuasive. And your generation will get this country headed back in the direction that you want it to be in.
You're back. A good speech is always good to hear, even twice and three times. And I'm sure that this speech is going to go down in history as one remarkable speech, because it cuts through all the BS that the politician usually tell us, and it tells the truth. It's honest to God, and he comes so clear and so beautiful that makes you understand what this man is all about. And you know, Trey Gowdy was one and is one of the fighters for the cause of the Benghazi accident, where I called it accident, but the accident was that American troops was not there to help Ambassador Stevens, which got killed by the mob in Benghazi. And Trey Gowdy was looking to search that, to listen to different stories, and still couldn't get the whole picture. And the whole picture will be revealed, because that's the nature of truth. It's always reveal itself. But I don't know if it's going to be in our time or later in generation and years to come, when people, you know, have the opportunity to open, close files. But we know for a fact that the Middle East is a jungle sometimes. Most of the countries, the Arabic countries, are no man's zone. And many groups are crossing over one to others. And we have so many people on the ground today that can inflict a lot of pain on a lot of civilized people and a lot of innocents, which is something that we need to prevent. That's why the ceasefire in Syria is very welcome. That's why the United Nations try to bring some help to those needy souls that are struggling with the fight for so long. That's why we're praying for those people. And while there are so many angels coming to build a shelter there and to help, we have so many people reaching out. I know that there is a request for some funds for the United Nations. They raised like $70 billion so far, but I think that they need to have some more. I'm sure it's $70 million. $70 billion sounds really incredible. Because they are expecting another 200,000 people that will flee from Aleppo in the next few days. And they are saying that they need to relocate them, find them some shelter, help them evacuate and come to safety, medical treatment, nutrition, clothes, first, you know, aids, whatever is needed. And 200,000 people, it's a lot of people, can be a lot of chaos. And the world needs to come to grip with the situation that now we are in the healing stage. And the fact that Russia stopped immediately the bombardment is a very good thing, and I hope that it will continue. That one with the news that's coming also from Russia today, that the Prime Minister of Russia, McDavid, is going to come to Israel next month, I think, and meet with the Prime Minister and other important people in the Commerce Department to start ignite some accords on international effort for economical growth. Right now, we have the opportunity to globalize the economy, and with the new deal of Brexit, we can join venture with England, America, Russian, and Israel in the Middle East and start bring the free zone to a different level. I know that we are in play, and it's a great time to start thinking what great business we can do together. So let's fix, you know, the wounded. Let's help them out, and let's keep on going. This world needs to ignite itself to a new day. So we need to listen to the news that's coming there, because we are still in the war, and the Syria-Iraqi war is still in the middle. I got something for you. Let's listen to it.
The battle for eastern Aleppo has reached a critical point. The Syrian armed forces and their allies appear to completely hold the strategic and operational initiative over the joint militant forces trapped in the city. It seems that the militant defences are now crumbling in the northern sector of the Aleppo pocket under the relentless offensive being pursued by the Syrian Arab Army and Liwa al-Quds, backed by Russian and Syrian air power. The 10th to the 12th of October witnessed pro-government forces maintain pressure on militant forces in the northeastern industrial limits of the city, attacking from three axes. This included the Jandul Axis, the Awija Axis, and the Brayej Axis. For 2 days, the jihadists held their perimeter. However, throughout the 13th to the 14th, the militants' line buckled and then broke, forcing a headlong retreat towards the Inzerat Hanano and Al-Haydariya suburbs. Over this period, the loyalist forces captured Tel Awija Hill, Tel Asfar Hill, and the Brayej sawmills. From the 15th to the 16th saw further gains for the pro-government forces with their liberation of the Inzerat Agriculture College from the Jabhat Fateh al-Sham terrorist group, the Al-Manashar Brayej suburb from the so-called Free Syrian Army Salafist Renegade faction, and a factory complex south of Awija from units of the Sultan Murad criminal gang. In doing so, the loyalists finished clearing the entire industrial outskirts of northern Aleppo and are now poised to make a push into the inner suburbs of eastern Aleppo proper. It is most likely that fighting from this point on will become very intense and desperate, and if militant forces begin to lose ground to pro-government forces, then we can expect a step up in the West's propaganda campaign against the Assad government and Russia. Further diplomatic and military escalation between all major powers involved in the conflict can also be expected.
All right, we're back. The Syrian situation is so grave that nobody knows how it's going to end up. The fact that they're going to take control over ISIS and over the, you know, the rebels will put Assad back in position to end all these people the way he did. So no diplomatic agreement still in play, and the cards are shifting, and we're not sure what way to go. But the fact of the matter is we need to take care of the people. So Assad cannot keep bombarding them, and Russia definitely is going to step down, not getting involved with the final solution on that area. We have another file on Syria. Let's listen to it.
Since our previous military report, the Syrian army, Harakat Hezbollah al-Mujahaba, Liwa al-Quds, and the Lebanese Hezbollah have achieved more gains in Aleppo city. They took control of the agriculture school located south of Tal Asfar and reached the youth housing complex north of the Hanano housing area. Now the army and Liwa al-Quds focused on military operations in the areas of the Baadin and Jandul roundabouts. By October 17th, the government forces had seized the Inzerat Heights near the Baadin roundabout and secured the areas near the neighborhoods of Ain al-Tal and Haydariya. A separate attempt to push through to Jabal Badro has not resulted in any notable success. The army and the National Defense Forces, NDF, also launched an operation advancing in the areas west of the Aleppo International Airport. Sheikh Lutfi is the goal. On October 17th, clashes intensified in Salah Adin, and the army took control of large parts of the 1070 apartment project. On October the 16th, the Syrian army's Tiger forces and the NDF liberated from Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, formerly Jabhat al-Nusra, Ara al-Sham and its allies, the strategic city of Ma'adas in the northern part of Hama province. This was the biggest success of the pro-government forces since the start of the massive counter-offensive in the province. The militant-controlled city of Suran will become the next target of the army and the NDF. Both Suran and Ma'adas are strategically located along the highway between the cities of Homs and Aleppo. The army also set up full control of the villages of Kudzia and Al-Hama, located near Damascus, after militants withdrew from the areas under the deal with the government. On October 17th, The army and the NDF continued operations in western Ghouta, aiming for the strategic town of Khan Shi. The government forces were developing the advance from the recently liberated town of Deir Kabiya. The militants' defences are on the verge of collapse in the region. Late on October 15th, the ISIS terrorist group withdrew from the area of Azaz in the northern part of Aleppo province. The ISIS forces were set to deploy in Arbab in order to prepare to defend this strategic city in Aleppo province. The next day, Turkish-backed militant groups, supported by the Turkish armed forces, took control of the cities of Dabik and Soran and the nearby areas, including Soran, Tilalayn, Salihiya, Bor-Anna, and Sunbul. On October the 15th, the Russian Northern Fleet officially announced that a group of warships, led by a heavy aircraft carrying missile cruiser, had started a cruise to the areas of the northeastern Atlantic and the Mediterranean. The group includes the Pyotr Veliki heavy nuclear missile cruiser, anti-submarine warships, the Vice Admiral Kulakov and the Severomorsk, as well as supply vessels. The Kuznetsov is expected to join up with a nuclear submarine, as well as Tu-160 long-range strategic bombers for anti-piracy and anti-terror exercises, before arriving in the eastern Mediterranean, where it will join the Russian forces fighting terrorists in Syria. The joint forces of the US-led coalition, the Iraqi government, the pro-government popular mobilization units, PMU, and the Kurdish Peshmerga, launched the long-awaited military operation to liberate the last ISIS major stronghold in Iraq, Mosul. Since Saturday, Mosul and the nearby areas have been the target of massive shelling and bombing campaigns by US artillery and the US-led coalition's air power. The joint anti-ISIS forces are aiming to secure the Mosul countryside before storming the ISIS stronghold itself. On October 16th, the Iraqi Army's 9th Division and the PMU liberated the city of Bashika from ISIS. The Peshmerga joined the operation northeast of Mosul. The Kurdish fighters will block ISIS escape routes and receive and screen refugees, but not enter the city. The Obama administration focused on attempts to retake Mosul after the widely promoted idea of liberation of Raqqa in Syria failed due to the ongoing Turkish-Kurdish tensions in northern Syria. There are also reports that US military staff have opposed that operation because it would weaken anti-Assad forces.
All right, the fight for Mosul, it's happening, and the Pashtuns, the Kurds, are really our heroes, and they go in front. But I know that once the Iraqi forces are going to get inside the city, only them, they're going to be the one to choose who's the militant or not, because they don't want to the other forces to come and start, determine themselves if they are the enemy or not. So they're trying to eliminate the problem by keeping the other forces, not the Iraqi forces, in the outskirts of the city. But they found the problem. They have mines and mines of bombardment that the ISIS prepare for them, and car bombs and a lot of mine in the city, and the houses are trapped. You can see the movies, you can see the faces. It's really dangerous. And something came to my mind saying, why people don't use drone to examine the route? If you can go around and take a drone and make sure that the mine are exploded before people arrive there, or they can detect them exactly and be careful, that will save a lot of lives. So drones are an invention that people need to start inserting into their projects, I assume. Now, before we end that, I want to send a prayer and a big, big good result for the forces of good to help people from the threatened area. And we need to finish with ISIS. So may it be a good day to finish with ISIS once and for all. And on that note, I want to give some respect to the chairman of UNESCO, that body that declared the position that the Jewish people have no right on the holy places, denying the Jewish people from their own rights and own ancestor Temple Mount. UNESCO chairman, she was very, very good on that stand. And let's listen to her.
His Excellency Mr. Junsik Lee, Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Education, Honorable Governor of Gyeonggi-do, Honorable Mayor of Suwon, President of the National Research Foundation of Korea, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I wish to thank the Ministry of Education of the Republic of Korea and the Suwon Municipal Council for hosting the 4th World Humanities Forum. I was honored to attend the first forum in 2011, and I'm deeply grateful for the continuous cooperation between the Korean Ministry of Education and UNESCO on an issue at the heart of our work, especially as we prepare the first World Humanities Conference to be held in Belgium in August 2017. I find the theme of this forum inspiring, the humanities of hope. Much in the world today invites cynicism and despair, but the sources of wonder and hope remain far greater. This is the importance of the humanities, to shine light on new opportunities for hope through dialogue on the basis of shared aspirations and respect for human rights. I am convinced the specific knowledge of the humanities can strengthen the foundations for more inclusive and sustainable societies. Literature, philosophy, history, law, linguistics, the creative arts, these disciplines study life and express it at the same time, in all its richness and diversity. In a world changing quickly, these anchors have never been so important. To deepen understanding, to provide meaning. This is why the world needs a new commitment to the humanities. In this spirit, I appeal to you all to be bold, to help UNESCO shape an agenda for the World Humanities Conference and beyond that can really make a difference. Thank you.
All right. That was UNESCO chairman woman. And thank God we have a woman that believes that actually humanity is to be sustained and not by the body of the UNESCO that decide that humanity is made only from one religion. You see, we need to start coming truth with our own creation, because once you create a body like United Nations and put inside 187 countries or more, and most of them are Muslim, you cannot prevail. There is no thing, and it must be rebalanced again and maybe abolished. United Nations, factors is to save the world, and they fail miserably if we want to take it in that direction, because America has taken the role of the charity position of helping everybody by force. Sometimes people don't like it. I know in the Philippines they're really mad at the American position there, but I guess that there is some reason, in the China Seas and around, there is some new developments. And we need to calculate what the position of United Nations. Why do we need a United Nations? When Great Britain took off from the European Union, they did it for a few reasons. One of the reasons was, we don't understand those unelected officials that are running our pockets and they are running the world. And the same thing with the United Nations. They're running the pockets of the world, and they're running, they have a free ride on whatever we give in and what they actually do. And helping people right now in Syria, those missions are incredible. Those are the volunteers. Those are people that dedicate their life. Those are the missionary kind of for humanity. And we have plenty of them, and thank God for that. But all those in the United Nations needs to be shuffled again and looked at very closely. And sometimes the mission statement needs to be changed or declared ahead of time. The fact that Israel loses every way you see it, and every time whatever happens is Israel fault, this is, it means that there is a default that is wrong. And we need to change it. Not because for Israel's sake that it's the Holy Land, the land of Israel that is the promised land that God promised to Abraham and, you know, Moses. And we are here to be the light to the world and hoping to help the world. We need to start doing that. And there are an obstacle for that. And I don't understand how we can get through them. And I know that right now I just got a petition to be signed to the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, which is UNESCO. It passed a draft resolution a past week denying Jewish connection to the Temple Mount and Western Wall in Jerusalem. And they need to, they're protesting. By failing to mention any connection to the Jewish people, to the Temple Mount, UNESCO has declared its position to hand over the rights and the authority of Judaism's most holy site to others. And those others, they're right here Palestinian, but I'm saying others. Because we need to come to truth, to the fact that there was never Palestinian state. So every time they call it occupied land, I want to know what kind of occupation is. Because I remember that in 1923, Israel got Israel, the Jewish home. For the Jewish people, got all the territory of Palestine that include Jordan. As far as I'm concerned, Orly Benny Davis here on BBS Radio and the Impossible Truth, I'm giving you the honest truth. In 1923, Israel had the property of all Palestinians, include Jordan. There was never a Palestinian state. The Palestinian land is a territory that was named by the Roman. I'm repeating it again because I know that somebody doesn't know. It's a fact. The Roman, when they left the Holy Land, they wanted to call it on the enemy of Israel. So they used Palestine. And that's why that name is on the land. Now, the territory is large, and it was occupied by the Ottoman Empire, meaning Turkey. Turkey was the owner after the Jewish people got deported from there. Now, once they had a shortcoming on the land, the universe, the world, global, power decided to take it away from Turkey, which was an empire, got a lost. You know, it happens. You go back, you go down, you go. This is the world of the humanity. You go up and you go down. So the world decided to take away, and they gave the Brits the mandate on that territory. 1923 in San Remo. We have a very clear map. You can check it online. It's not a story. The map includes to the Jewish people the land of the Palestinian territory. And the mandate of the Brits was to create a Jewish homeland for the Jewish people that were always all around. But then they didn't. They were slow in coming. And after the Holocaust came, they start coming much stronger, even though that the Brits cut a deal with the Arab Sheikh in 1933, I think, and they gave and they created a Transjordan for the Hashemite Empire. That was when they cut the land in less than half, and they gave the less than the half to Israel, of course, and then. In 1947, the United Nations finally recognized the declaration of the Balfour Declaration for 1917 and the San Remo Agreement 1923, and they came along and 47 November 29, 1947, they said the resolution 181. Listen to this. They said that there will be a Jewish state, but they're gonna divide it again. Okay? Let's say they took another part. No, they're dividing the Jewish land. It's not like there is an occupied, there is no Palestinian, so they're taking away. All right? Now, in 181, the same resolution that created the state of Israel, there is also closure about Jerusalem. Jerusalem, since it wasn't declared by anybody like its own, which it's a shortcoming of the Jewish people, I admit to that, but I would call it now that we need to declare Jerusalem again the Jewish capital. 181 resolution 181 stated that Jerusalem is corpus separatum. It means that it's international. It belongs to everybody. So every time they say Jerusalem belongs to the Arabs or Jerusalem Temple Mount is Muslim, they're actually saying against their own resolution 181, saying that it's international. If it's international, how can it be occupied? That's all. And Judea and Samaria, the same story. The Turks got it taken away. The Brits give it to the Jewish people. Then the United Nations divided. And there is no occupation of any sort. So for God's sake, stop using that word when it's insane to even connect it to the reality. The truth of the matter is that it's a story that was invented and created by people that are nomad, and they were living. Of course, there were a lot of Arabs, and there still are in the state of Israel, which are trying to become Palestinian, but let's send them to Palestine if they want. Don't know which kind of creation they're going to have, because when Israel gave up Gaza, she gave up a territory to the Palestinian people, of course. And right then, what they created? Tunnels to explode Israel. That's all. That's what they're doing in Mosul. That's what they're founding in Iraq now, the ISIS. All those invaders, all those people that come and try to take over another people's property, land, they're terrorists, of course. And that's the only thing they know to do. It's not organized machine. It's not organized social life like Jewish people have. No, you take a Jewish club and you bring it in, they'll organize the film, the movies, the lecture, the food, everything. Because they organize civilization. Now, those Palestinians, I don't know what organized them, but definitely not society. All right? And then when they want to come and take a part of what is created already, it's really nice. You know, I know a lot of terrorists. Oh, no, I don't know terrorists. But I'm saying a lot of stories about people that want to take over other people's work. It's easy. It's normal, right? That's what they're trying to do. And Jerusalem, it's in the same. And that's why I want to call it a bluff. And I want to call it a bluff also on the declaration that they're going to evacuate the city of Amona, or the settlement they call in Judea and Samaria of Amona. The court, the higher court of Israel, say they need to evacuate it because it's Palestinian land. Bogus. The Israeli court cannot have no religious jurisdiction over the authority of Judea and Samaria. So she cannot command anything there, and she can definitely not command the army. That's why it's a bogus statement. It's a really ludicrous from the world to expect the Israelis to start obeying something that it's not even conveniently within the rule of law. So let's get justice where it belongs in the just way, and let's give some credit to the people who actually know the law and respect it and want justice before God and man to be right. And it's about time we start working on that page. All right, we're running out of time, and I know it's been fabulous today. Thank God for you. Thank God for everybody. Thank God for you guys that are there working hard, your heart out, to make this world better. We need you. We love you. We want you to be strong, because remember, we are with you. You're not alone. We all in the midst. We're struggling together. We're going to bring this world back to where it belongs, because God is mighty and He's on our side. And if anybody of the candidate tonight that will start thinking about the way to God, to bring, but I'm not saying fanatic God, like, you know, those people that wants to kill for that. We're talking respectful, love, kindness, caring, taking care of humanity, environment, animals, children, taking care of, and not that order, of course, but taking care of the world and the love that we need to give it to make it shine, to make it beautiful. Guys, there is a great world out there. Let's go. Snap out of it. We can make it again. And I know Donald Trump is really a bad man with girls. But Hillary Clinton and her pals wanted to eradicate God from our way, from people, from the belief. That is the most obscene act of humanity, to go against God. So I would call it up and say, Donald Trump, get to the plate and make it a win, for God's sake. God bless you all. I love you. Let's talk Monday. Ciao, ciao.